From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. You're listening to the tap dancing of 2021 National Heritage Fellow, Reginald Reggio the Hoofer McLaughlin. And we're closing out Black History Month by revisiting my interview with this extraordinary dancer. For more than half a century, Reggio McLaughlin has been the embodiment of joyous dance as he's tapped his way through Chicago's stages and streets, classrooms, and festivals. His distinctive tapping, historical knowledge, and ebullient personality has given him a well-deserved reputation as a passionate performer and dedicated teacher who has kept this dance tradition alive and thriving. Reggio is also a great storyteller, so I'm going to keep this short and just mention a few of his highlights. He began as an R&B musician and then was mentored by the great tap dancer Jimmy Payne, which gave him a solid foundation in dance and a great respect for tradition. Making his own opportunities, he was a busker in Chicago's subways until he came to the attention of Urban Gateways, a nonprofit that brings the arts to underserved children. In 1994, he met Ernest Brownie Brown, a legendary dancer who performed on Broadway with Duke Ellington and Count Basie, and was one of the co-founders of the extraordinary dance ensemble, the Copacetics. Brownie and Reggio teamed up and danced together for nearly two decades. Meanwhile, 27 years ago, Reggio began teaching tap at the Old Town School of Folk Music, where he's still an in-demand teacher. He's performed around the world and throughout the country, but for Reggio, it all begins and ends in his hometown of Chicago.
I would say I'm pure Chicago. Born Chicago, raised in Chicago, even though I had opportunities to probably move to other cities, and especially New York, because that was kind of like a real tap mecca. But I always stayed here in Chicago. I always felt like Chicago was good to me, and I'm just proud to be a Chicagoan, you know, and I wanted to be like a good example and a light for other youths coming up here in Chicago and let them know, hey, look, I started out performing in the subways and in the streets in Chicago, and if I can do it, I believe that you can do it too.
When did you fall in love with tap dancing, Reggio?
When I was a kid, probably around 7 years old, in Chicago, they had what we call park districts, which was like a community center. They had a lot of after-school programs. And at that time, that's where my mother would send us, and my older sister and them would be taking tap because they offered that mainly for the girls. And then there was a divider in the gym, and the boys did more gymnastics, stuff like that. And at the end of the program, they have a showcase where they invite the parents to come see what the kids learn, and you invite your friends and everybody. And when I saw tap, I just fell in love with the rhythm, the sound, the movement. And it was love at first sight. At that moment, it just stuck with me in my heart and my soul for life.
But you didn't start tap lessons then, did you?
No, I couldn't. I had a large family, eight of us. You know, your mother's just trying to make it day by day and survive. So I would ask my sisters, hey, show me a step, show me a step. I'd go out on the sidewalk and put some bottle tops on my gym shoes, try to get that sound. And I kind of worked with some homemade tap shoes that way because I never really had, like, the opportunity, you know, like formal training where you would go to a school or some type of dance academy to learn. And that's how it began from that point. And as I got older, that's when I was introduced to veteran Hoofers, veteran Broadway vaudeville Hoofers later on.
You had a whole other and very successful career as an R&B bassist.
Oh, shoot.
When you were a kid. How did this happen?
Oh, my father used to play guitar around the house. My older brother, he got my father to show him some chords and teach him how to play guitar. I admired my big brother. I'm like, oh, man, can I hang with you? Can I hang with you? Nah, man, you can't hang with me. You're too little and all of that stuff. So one day he say, look, Reg, yo, he say, why don't you learn how to play bass? And if once you learn how to play bass, we can start a band together. And I feel like, oh, yeah, that's so great. This is my opportunity to hang with my big brother. So he started teaching me how to play bass when I was around 12 years old. And then long story short, there's a record company in Chicago. It's called Brunswick Records. Brunswick Records were the rhythm and blues sound of Chicago, the way Motown Records in Detroit was the Motown sound. So my brother, one of his mentors, got him a job at Brunswick Records, and he was getting ready to go out of town with one of the recording artists there, and the bass player got sick. He said, look, my little brother know how to play bass. You know, I could teach him all the songs and everything tonight, and he could go with us. And they had no other choice. So they said, okay, good. And so he asked my mother. My mother grieved because, you know, we lived on the South Side. We lived in a very tough neighborhood, and she felt like this was a way that would get me out of this tough neighborhood, and I went. They were so impressed with my playing that they kept me on with the recording company, but they gave me an ultimatum. Yeah, man, either you can go to school, which I was about in my sophomore year, or you could stay with the company. I chose to stay with the company because of the circumstances at the time of being able to get off that neighborhood, out of that neighborhood. And on Brunswick Records, they had people like Jackie Wilson, the Shy Lights, Tyrone Davis, Lost Generation. So they had a number of top-notch artists. So I fell into that because I wanted to hang with my brother. But you know what was so funny? I still always wanted a tap. But yeah, so I did that. And I'm very glad because that experience that I got from being around a record company now allows me to write my own music and songs. With my tap dancing now, I do a lot of shows with live musicians, so I'm able to tell them what I want and the intro, how long I want it to be. And my future endeavors that I'm working on a one-man show, and I'm writing all original music from it. So I think, you know, destiny had just a way of taking you down a whole lot of different avenues, and now I'm putting them all together for a masterpiece.
I bet. How long did you do that?
Oh, I did that for a while. So I was 15. I could have did it till my early 20s. What really happened was, at that time, all the clubs had live music, so when you wasn't traveling on the road, you could, you know, playing some of the bars and stuff at night. I was playing, believe it or not, back then, you could play in the bars at a young age, you know, but, you know, you just wasn't allowed to drink or anything like that. So I was playing in the clubs at 15 years old in Chicago.
How did you transition from...
From there, playing,
yeah, to tap.
What happened was Saturday Night Fever came out with the disco music and everything. And when they did that, all the clubs started getting disco DJs in and everything, and they weren't hiring live bands no more. When things transitioned and live music was being kind of evaporated in the clubs, I felt like this was a great opportunity for me to pursue what I always wanted to do, tap dance. And by me playing the music, it gave me the money that I need to train with these veteran dancers.
And one of those veteran tap dancers who you learned from was Jimmy Payne.
Jimmy Payne, right. Okay. So he taught in here in Chicago at a time at a studio, 218 South Wabash. That was like an artsy building. And I went to Jimmy and he started teaching me. But see, at the time that I started working with him, tap was an outdated dance that nobody didn't do anymore. So people kind of thought like, man, this guy's nuts. You want to learn how to tap? Nobody does that anymore. And not only that, they didn't understand why I wanted to tap when I was like one of the top 10 bass players in Chicago, you know, but it never went away. I wanted to tap. And all during that time that I was playing bass, I was still, you know, dabbing with my tap here and there. But then finally when I got with Jimmy, that's when it really transitioned to become my main priority.
As you said, tap dancing was considered outdated and
there
weren't gigs. So you began dancing in the subways in Chicago.
Correct, because you had to make your own opportunity if you wanted to tap. And that's what I wanted to do. I had offers for jobs and things, and I was like, nope, nope. So I would go down there and tap dance. If you ask people, can you borrow a little money? No, cut your hair, you know, get a real job. So I, I went through all kind of obstacles of people trying to deter me and change me for not tapping. But I stood my ground, man, and I let that happen. Everybody was trying to change you. If you meet a young lady, you meet her parents, they ask you, oh, so what do? Oh, I'm a tap dancer. Parents look at you, tap dancer, that ain't no job. That's like a hobby or a recreation. I'm like, no, not with me. I was proud of it. And I stood up. So, but after that, you be kind of, you know, was just like, hey, little daughter, I think you need somebody going to the university or college to be a doctor or a lawyer or something, a tap dancer. So I went through a lot to go all the way with this. I was getting hit all kind of ways of different obstacles coming at me, but I didn't let that stop me, though. You know, I really, really paid the dues down there. And then the subway was rough.
I was going to say, it's not for the faint-hearted.
No, you can't be weak down there. Look, sometimes I had to wake up in an hour or two to condition my mind to go down there. You know, it wasn't like here you got a paid audience and you had all kind of people down there in the subway. Some of the teenagers, they made fun of you. Oh, man, look at that. Well, man, my uncle could do that and da-da-da-da-da. And you, so you had to deal with that.
I would think tap dancing in the subway would really, really help you to figure out very quickly what people liked and how to connect with people.
Oh, that's where it all began. That's where my whole stage persona come from down there. And I love it because I develop an intimate relationship with people. And I bring that to the stage because you're right there on the same level of the people, you know, toe-to-toe. And, hey, how you doing, Hoodfoot man? I ain't got nothing to give you today, but I get paid Friday if you're down here. You know, I toss you a little something, you know, and you discover what steps and combination the people like when they clap. Yay, that's it, you know, and you write that down. Okay, I got to keep that over the top. They really like that one. And it makes you work, you know, them people down there and they'll clap. All right, get it, brother. Go ahead on, man. And root you on and whatnot like that. But my whole stage persona came from in the subway and being with people. And even now, even though when I perform on stage, if I had a choice, I do a lot of school performances. And they say, do you want to be on the stage or do you want to be on the floor? All the time. I just want to be on the floor where I could talk with people. And I have a lot of audience participation and student participation. I'm able to get them right up and dance with me. And the people, when it's like that, they become more a part of your performance than just being a spectator.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
You began working with Urban Gateways.
Yes, I did. That was the beginning of my rise, was with Urban Gateway.
Explain what they do and how you got together and what you did for them.
Okay. Urban Gateway, that's where I learned the format of art in the form of education. And what they do, they prepare different genres of art to perform in the educational system, like schools, libraries, museums. So their tap act at the time left their institution. So one of the program directors would always see me and myself and another dancer down there performing. So when they left, she came down there and got us and said, okay, I would like you guys to come and meet me at Urban Gateway. We're interested in putting you guys a program together to perform in the schools. So, you know, we met with her, and the name of the program was called Taps and Tuxedos. And actually what they do, they write out your whole program that you're going to do in the schools. It's a scripted program, and you know you stick to the script. Everything is very well structured. So we came, and they work with us, and we have to run our program over and over until it reached satisfactory to their standard. And once it reached that, then they will have a showcase, and they invite all the schools to come and on a retreat, a weekend retreat, and then they present all the new artists that they're going to present for that following year. Then they see you, and hey, we love it, and start booking you, man. And our act was hot. 5 years, we was just everywhere.
And did you like working in schools?
I loved it, working in school. I loved everywhere I perform and dance at, because it gave me more knowledge to go with the knowledge that I have as a dancer. Because if I go into the school, you weren't able to just go in there with pure entertainment. There had to be an educational part to that. So we'll talk about the origin history of tap. Sometimes I would go to other, like, high schools and stuff, and I would have to adapt a program to fit in with, like, more of the Renaissance, Harlem Renaissance era, and make it a part of a history class. So I always had to adjust what I do to adapt to different formats.
Now, you met the great tap dancer Ernest Brown, and he became your mentor. How did you hook up with him?
What happened was, I went to school with a young lady named Frances. She kept telling me her grandfather was a tap dancer, and next time he come in town, she'd introduce me to him. She introduced me to him, and eventually, shortly after that, he moved back to Chicago, and I would go over there, visit, and stay with him, and he started working with me, teaching me a lot of the very authentic, traditional styles of tap dancing. And he turned out to be one of the co-founding members of a very elite tap company at the time called the Copacetics. And the Copacetics, they established themselves in 1949 after passing of Bill Bojangles Robinson, who taught Shirley Temple how to dance. And when I came over there, and I would always ask him, show me this, show me that, and he would. And then later on, we end up choreographing a little tap for a musical at that time called Tommy Parker Black Minstrel Show, because they didn't have a choreographer. And one of the actors asked what I would give him a few moves to go with a monologue he was doing. And when I found out they didn't have nobody choreographing for them because they wanted to do a cakewalk from back in that era, I said, well, look, since y'all don't have a choreographer, my mentor, he knows how to teach you a cakewalk and all of that. And so anyway, they brought us on board, and one of the critics wrote about us choreographing this show, and then everything snowballed from there.
And you learned a lot of tap history from Brown.
Firsthand history, because he should say, he would see something, and he said, you know what, Reggio? He said, you see that, what they saying right there in this book or this and that? He said, that's not true. He said, that's from the author's point of view. He said, because I was actually there when this happened or that happened. But one of the greatest things that he taught me that I like, he told me, when we used to go perform, he said, you know what, Reg? He said, all the dancers, most of the dancers today are too spoiled. He said, you go to a theater, oh, I can't dance on that floor. This floor is this. That floor is that. Oh, it's too shiny. Oh, it's this. He said, man, when we was back in the day, whatever the condition of the floor was, that's what you danced on if you wanted to work. It was like non-negotiable. That's the floor, and that's what you had to dance on. So he really kept me so down to earth and so humble, you know, because coming out of the era that he came in, he showed me a much more better appreciation for the art itself.
I want you to share a little bit of the history of tap, its origins, how far back you can trace it.
You know what? You get these different theories and stuff, but I'm going to tell you purely the way it was told and introduced to me. I was always told when the Africans were brought to America and they were prohibited from playing the drum, they began to substitute that with their feet and then use their feet to beat out and tap out certain rhythms and things in place of the drums. And that developed into an art form on the plantations. And that's where it was always brought to me, and that's the way I accepted, because I could I understood that. And then when you see when they brought tap to the stage, you know?
It's such an American art form.
Totally an American art form. And it came with musical theater right from the beginning when they presented it on stage. It came right there as an art form that developed here in America and continued to develop, coming out of minstrel shows up into vaudeville and then Hollywood. The Hollywood is what put the glamour into the tap with the marble floors and the tuxedos. And, you know, now you got all these fabulous musical. So it's an art form, yeah, that developed here and is accepted. And it's funny, I taught workshops all over the world, and especially Brownie Legacy. People came from all over the world to study tap here in America. And it was good because Brownie passed a lot of authentic, traditional styles of tap and dance, and especially routines that they did and that were created and developed here in America. Yes.
I want you to describe the chair dance because that's one of them.
Oh, my God. Well, okay, when I got with Urban Gateway, because it was art in the form of education, I would go to the library and try to pull up whatever tap tapes that I can ever find that they had. And the Copacetics, five members of them, they did a 2 days series on the Dick Cavett Show. And one of the dances I saw him do was the chair dance. Oh, my God. Out of all the complex dances I do, the chair dance is my number one favorite.
And it's a very complicated tap dance that's performed while you're sitting down.
Yes.
Was it created by the Copacetics?
Yes. Copacetics, they created this chair dance. Man, and it's just a beautiful classic. And Brownie showed me the dance, and I've been doing it and carrying on that legacy from then all the way until this very day.
How long did you dance with Ernest Brown?
About 18 years until he was almost 92. You know, we danced all the way to good to the very last drop. So, you know, we had to go in a nursing home. And one of the things that we did as a new generation of tap dancers, we turned back the hands of time and we honored the forefathers that were still around because we felt like they didn't get the credit that they justly were supposed to get when they were around because they was back doing a lot of Jim Crow days, you know? So that was our way of paying honor and tribute to them. So I kept them with me from then on.
Well, in the mid-90s, you began teaching at the Old Town School of Folk Music.
Yeah.
And you're still there.
27 years. I put all that tap, a lot of stuff out there. Might only had two or three dance teachers at the time. And, yeah, I stayed there. It's so funny when all the things that I did, I didn't plan anything. It's almost like by just dancing and destiny took me down the path that continue to develop and escalate into different aspects of my art form to like producing shows. I produced 2 annual shows. My holiday show, The Nut Tapper, was based on the Nutcracker Ballet, but I do a hip variation of that. And then a National Tap Day, which is honored into law in 1989 as a true American folk dance. I honored that by doing a National Tap Day performances as well.
And that's Bill Robinson's
birthday.
That's
Bill Robinson's birthday. Yeah, they made it on May 25th.
And that's what I wanted to talk to you because you're not just teaching tap. You're giving students a history, or your audience, it's a history of tap.
You have
to. It's social context as you teach.
Yeah, you have to. Because when you get a history, now they understand and they connect with you so much better. You as a bona fide dancer, you understand that, you know, you at the same time you entertain and performing, but you're also on a mission of sharing the knowledge that you know and the educational aspects of what you're doing, you know, and how the dance, you know, has been created and developed as American folk dance, you know. Because when you say America to me, America means all, A-L-L, all. Because we, you know, you have all kind of Americans here. I would just feel like somebody has to keep the traditional American tap alive. And I felt like that was part of what I wanted to do as well.
As you said, you do two shows a year for the Old Town School.
Yeah, those are the ones that I produce, and I incorporate all my students that I teach for them, and they love that.
I want you to tell me a little bit about the Nut Tapper, because that show's been going on for what?
2021, yeah. Yet. I never had no idea that... it would go on that long. I thought I would do it one time. After I did a show, my first show at Old Town in the 90s was called The History of Tap, you know, and I kind of mixed it all up. And then I was approached, man, you should do a holiday show, around Christmas show. Oh, okay. What should I do? Okay, well, you know, everybody do the, all the ballet dancers do that Nutcracker. Right, Sarah, the Nutcracker. So I say, maybe you should do the Nut Tapper or the, you know, that. And then I'm doing the Nut Tapper. So at that point, I've never saw the Nutcracker ballet, and I didn't understand it. So I went and to the library and got videotapes on the Nutcracker. I watched the show. Then I went to some ballet performances of it. And what happened was when I was watching the ballet, you could not follow what was going on, even though they're telling the story through the dance. It was hard to follow the story through the dance if you didn't already know what the story was. And I was like, wow, that's puzzling. So I decided, okay, when I did my show, I'm going to get me a real hip, talk that talk, walk that walk narrator. So I got me one of these Def Jam poet kind of guy. And he's going to narrate the show. And I wrote out, and now my show, it's really a show that really we talk about take place in Chicago. Instead, in a party scene, I decided we having a tap jam. So I spice everything up. And then in my presentation is where I could always switch and bring different guest artists. So that's when I would incorporate other percussive dance styles like flamenco, because I studied that, and Mexican zapateado. Sometimes I could put in any variety of dance. So I bring in different cultural styles of dance. Sometimes I bring in the Indian dance. I could bring in just different dance. So at the same time, it's very multicultural style of a dance, you know. And then my Nut Tapper is like me, and he got locks in his hair. Yeah, they made me a little doll like me with locks in his hair since I quit locks.
That's great.
Yeah, it's funny. You laugh in that show. It's
a lot of fun. You've been a part of the Old Town School's international program quite a few times.
Yes.
Tapping your way to Europe and India and South America.
Oh, my God, that India trip. It was a 24-hour plane ride from Chicago nonstop to India. I was up in there 24 hours. Imagine seeing the sun go up, go down, and then come back up again.
How did audiences react to and respond to this really American art
let
form?
Let me tell you something. Ooh, ooh, ooh. the one thing that first is that the dance is a universal language. You know, whether you spoke the language or not, they can feel that heartbeat in that dance. Because they do a foot stomping dance called kata, if I'm not pronouncing it incorrect. And oh my God, but they do it barefooted. But when they hear the tap sound, and not only that, I did a fusion with an Indian dancer while we was there who did the kata, and I did the tap dance, and oh my God, I think they just love that. Oh, I never been to anywhere in any country that did not like tap dance. You know, they love the musicals that came from America with tap in them. And then the amazing thing about it is you go to these places, and I'm going to tell you, 95% of people have never seen it done live. And that's what really wipes them out. And then you get through dancing, they calling you over, they want to see the bottom of your shoe. You know, they want to try them on and all of that stuff, you know. So, yeah, everybody's just amazed with it. You know what I mean? Especially when you see you just using your body that way and beating out these rhythms. Man, how do you do that? You know? And then it was just so cool after I would do my art form and in Indian dance, I would do hers, and then we'd do something together. That was the beauty. It kind of brought that unity, and the art brought us all together.
A tap dance is so joyous.
Yeah, it's a happy dance, you know?
It is a happy dance. It really is.
Yeah, make people happy and fun. And especially, one of the things I love doing is just go get somebody out the audience and bring them up to dance with me. Oh, do they love that? And the kids love that. And so it creates a very beautiful environment for you.
If you think of your legacy, Reggio, what would you like it to be?
I would like it to be and make people feel like there was a saying that to say in the neighborhood, if you're true to it, it will be true to you. And that's what I want people to feel like. If you really believe in what you're doing, you love it, and it's something that's very pure and wholesome, you can do it. You know, you'll be all right. It will be all right for you. Be prepared for all the obstacles that are going to come and get in their way from every form and fashion, and that they have to be strong enough to overcome those and don't let it deter them from maintaining that path and keep on going. I've seen how what I did in my art form made a mark of making people happy. I've taught hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. And when you get these feedbacks of how happy it made them, and it just brought some kind of joy in their life and, you know, made their life a little more, like, worth living for, then that's what I would look for, just to continue to get that kind of feedback from people.
You've won many awards, many, many awards, too many to list. But now you've been named an NEA National Heritage Fellow. Tell me what that means to you.
What can come up against like a National Endowment Fellowship Award, the highest award of the nation? You know what I'm saying? I'm living in heaven and glory days every day that I think about that. I wake up in the middle of the night and just thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. You know, because it's like, I did a lot of things and I worked very hard. You know, you go through the test of time, you stick to the path and everything. And sometimes, you know, I never felt like people were even paying attention to all of that hardship and, you know, the trials and tribulation that you had to go through to get to that point. A lot of things that I dealt with, a lot of people don't know, and I never let, hey, you all, bring out the violins, because I got a story to tell. I never do that. But also, you know, I really want to say, I don't think I would have made it as this far as just a solo. I have my help, like I have Sarah Gondella here, I have Jim Berry here. They with me and they listen to me and what I'm saying. And then I have a lot of students. I have Old Town School of Folk Music, you know, that believed in what I was doing and gave me a platform to continue my work, you know, and it kind of gives you that motivation that helps you.
You created a community.
I think so.
Yeah,
it feels good when you walk through the neighborhood. People are like, "Hey, Nut-Tapper, hey, Nut-Tapper." You know, "Radio, I saw your show. I saw your show." You know, some people had that hard to handle when they walk with me. "Oh, you just know everybody. Everybody know you." Well, what can you say? You know, I've been out there all my life.
Well, Reggio, congratulations. This award is so well-deserved, and I just send you my congratulations my good wishes across this wire.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That was tap dancer and 2021 National Heritage Fellow, Reginald Reggio the Hoofer McLaughlin. And stay tuned. We're about to release the names of the 2024 National Heritage Fellows. Keep checking arts.gov or follow us on Instagram at NEA Arts. Thanks to filmmaker Olivia Marion for the sound of Reggio's tapping. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating on Apple. It helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.